Last time we spoke about Operation Thursday and the ferocious counteroffensive on Bougainville. The Chindits embarked on their second great raid, this time better equipped, better trained, and more numerous than ever. With a literal armada of beasts of burden, they marched through Burma, forded the Chinwin, and began attacking and establishing strongholds. This was all done in coordination with General Slim and Stilwell's forces, trying to break the Japanese and gradually seize back lost territory. Wingate had his work cut out for him, as the Chindits were providing real results, yet unfortunately he would not have long to see them. Wingate was killed in a B-25 crash, and it felt like the personality of the Chindits left with him. Over on Bougainville, the Japanese tossed as much as they could to try and break through the Americans' perimeter to hit the airfield, but it was all for naught. This episode is The Bombing of Hollandia and Palau. Welcome back to the Pacific War Week by Week podcast. I'm your dutiful host, Craig Watson. But before we begin, I just want to remind you all that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Perhaps you want to learn a bit more about World War II? Kings and Generals has an assortment of episodes on World War II and so much more, so go give them a look over at YouTube. So please subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all of that you are still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there I just released a full documentary on the Battle of Attu. Also, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where I have exclusive podcasts. Over there I just released a two-part series on the entire history of the USS Enterprise. Check it out, it would mean a lot to me. Operation Brewer saw General MacArthur tossing cavalry against the eastern side of Los Negros. General Swift's 1st Cavalry Division successfully landed on Los Negros and managed to secure Sealer Harbor rather quickly. After this, General Chase's 1st Brigade was given the task of mopping up the island. By March 11th, daily patrols had determined that the entire area from the Mokarang Peninsula to the southeast point and as far west as Porlaca was generally free of the enemy. The 1st Squadron, 5th Cavalry, pushed its perimeter at Mamut west and south to the water barriers of the La Mandral Creek and Ion Lagoon. The 12th Cavalry beachhead at Salami continuously patrolled into the interior and encountered so few Japanese, it was clear the enemy lacked sufficient numbers to harass the troops on the peninsula. West of the La Mandral Creek was a completely different story. While the troops holding the beachheads from Lombrum to Papitalai waited for the supply channels to be established, they probed to locate the center of the enemy resistance. The 12th Cavalry was responsible for the beachheads at the Papitalai Mission and Lombrum. The 2nd Squadron had captured Papitalai Mission, and on the 11th, the 1st Squadron had taken over the Lombrum Point, relieving the 7th Cavalry so they could attack Manus Island. The 5th Cavalry held the Papitalai perimeter with Troop F. When the regiment extended its control over the area east of La Mandral and the Parhaimenimen Creeks on the 11th, the 2nd Squadron moved into the Porlaca area, while the 1st Squadron on the left flank was concentrated near the southeast point. It was planned that the 12th Cavalry would do most of its fighting in the northern sector, moving inland from the coastal positions, to cut out the Japanese hammered at by the 5th Cavalry as it pushed its way west to both sides of La Mandral Creek. Since the 8th, Troop F patrols from Papitalai had run into enemy resistance in the hilly country to the west. Although small patrols of squad size or slightly larger were held up day after day by resistance, about 800 yards west of Papitalai, the first encounters did not reveal the full strength of the enemy pocket. When an attack by a platoon of Troop E reinforced by two tanks, two bazookas, and flamethrowers was repulsed on the 11th, the strength of the enemy strong point became clearer. The enemy was well dug in along the ridge, marked by a series of knobs, running west from Papitalai. The highest point, Hill 260, about 2,500 yards from Papitalai, not to be mistaken for Hill 260 on Bougainville, by the way, this was probably the center of the enemy's defenses. However, the two knobs east of 260, well-defended outposts, prevented any movement further into the interior. The position 800 yards from Papitalai, which had repulsed Troop E, was defended by a platoon with knee mortars and at least three machine guns. The total enemy strength facing the 5th Cavalry was estimated to be 150 to 200 Japanese. Now that was the ongoings of Los Negros, but Brigadier General Vern Mudge's 2nd Brigade was now preparing to invade Manus Island. American intelligence was unsure of the disposition of the enemy on Manus. They roughly estimated there was 2,700 Japanese concentrated there, and most likely they would make a last stand on Lorangao. The Americans expected they would put up a last losing fight, but because of the lack of knowledge of their numbers and disposition on the largest island of the Admiralties, this would require careful planning for the invasion. Fighting into the interior where the mountain range would provide defensive positions, and through the swampy forest covering the rest of the island would not be easy. There were only 4 roads winding about the island and converging at Lorangao that would be suitable for moving vehicles, and long stretches of these red clay roads would be impassable in rainy weather. Surrounding jungle and swamps would confine any large-scale movements to these roads. Therefore, the plan was to pin the enemy down at the coast, where it was expected his concentrated main strength would be. Mudge planned to land troops A and C of the 8th Cavalry Regiment at Yellow Beaches at Lugo's Mission. When the 8th Cavalry had secured a beachhead, including the Lugo's Mission itself, each squadron would then advance east, the 1st Squadron along the coast using No. 3 Road, and the 2nd along an inland road known as the No. 1 Road, to execute a wide sweep towards Lorangao. If a sizable garrison was concentrated at the fortified position of Lorangao, the inland arm of this attack would prevent the enemy from escaping along the only road leading west to the mountain areas. Prior to the assault, 3 patrols had been sent to Bear Point on Manus, and on the islands of Buchulo and Highway. Mudge planned to deploy artillery at these places to aid in the assault. Bear Point was found to have no enemy, but unfortunately it was not suitable to place artillery. The northern island of Buchulo was an excellent site for artillery, and it was found to be unoccupied. Highway would turn out to be another story completely. The American patrol moved out from Salami on an LCV and a PT boat, landing without any opposition on the western end of the island. Major Carter Vannon of the 99th Field Artillery Battalion threw 2 grenades into a well-camouflaged bunker about 10 yards from the beach, and a party progressed inland. Immediately after the grenade explosions, a mortar shell landed on the beach in rear of the party. From 3 sides, machine gun, rifle, mortar fire opened up. Fortunately, the grenades had evidently sprung a planned ambush prematurely, and the party was not cut off from the rear. Using their submachine guns, the men of the patrol were able to hold back the enemy. They were aided by some supporting fire from the PT boat and by a .30 caliber machine gun on the LCV. After 2.5 hours, they managed to withdraw to the water's edge. The PT boat had returned its tender after the commanding officer was wounded, and the coxswain of the LCV shouted and motioned for the cavalrymen to get on board, but only 5 of them actually reached the boat, as the others were engaged with the enemy on shore. The LCV had troubles of its own. Enemy mortar fire and machine gun fire found its range and wounded all aboard except for 2. Then the LCV grounded on a submerged piece of coral, and it sank 200 yards offshore after receiving a direct hit from a mortar round. The wounded men put into life jackets floated about in the water. When the remaining members of the patrol on shore waded out towards the LCV, 6 Japanese attempted to set up a machine gun on the beach. The men were all cut down using submachine gun fire. Still under fire, the cavalrymen swam out to the survivors of the LCV, making a group of 18 of them in the water. Failing to attract the notice of the destroyers nearby, the tired men had to stay in the water for over 3 hours until a PT boat picked them up. At the same time, a destroyer closed in to the island to draw hostile fire and bombard the enemy positions on the western end. Highway was going to need some extra help to be secured. The 2nd Squadron 7th Cavalry departed from Lumbrum Point on the 11th and landed on Buchulo. The next day, destroyer gunfire and rockets, as well as 105mm concentrations from the 71st Field Artillery Battalion at Mokarang Point, battered Highway. Then Kitty Hawks of the 77th Pursuit Squadron, coming out of Momote Airfield, bombed and strafed Highway. After all of this, the 2nd Squadron landed on Highway, meeting slight resistance at the beach. They advanced 300 yards further inland, where they became pinned down by heavy rifle, machine gun, and mortar fire. The Japanese were firing upon them from some bunkers, prompting the 2nd Squadron to dig in and allow artillery teams to hit them throughout the night. During the night, the 61st Field Artillery Battalion from the northern end of Mokarang Plantation fired 1,000 rounds to harass the enemy. This fire was directed so accurately and carefully that it was brought down upon the enemy within 100 yards of the cavalrymen's positions, without causing any friendly fire. It helped minimize enemy activity during the night. At 10 a.m. on the 13th, with support of a medium tank, the cavalrymen stormed the bunkers along the edges of the island. The Japanese put up a valiant fight, but they lacked anti-tank weaponry. By 12 p.m., the 2nd Squadron successfully mopped up the enemy, suffering 8 deaths with 46 wounded. They estimated they had killed 43 Japanese, who were all naval personnel. Having secured the two islands, now one artillery battalion set up on Botyolo and two others on Highway. The next day at 7 a.m., the three artillery battalions opened fire upon the Laurengau Township area. This target was chosen to divert the enemy's attention from landing beaches around Lugo's Mission. Meanwhile, four destroyers bombarded Laurengau with their 5-inch guns. Then, 18 B-25s coming out of Nadsab bombed and strafed the Lugo's Mission and the beach areas until H-5 minutes. Between 9:07 to 9:25 a.m., they dropped 81 500-pound bombs, strafed with more than 44,000 rounds of machine gun fire, and cleared the target area just as the troops were coming ashore. The 8th Cavalry departed Salami, heading for Yellow Beaches, covered by three rocket boats. The wave of buffaloes drew up to the beaches, and it appeared as if they were going to make it without any opposition until the enemy machine guns opened fire from the east of the landing beaches. Immediately, the buffaloes responded with their own machine gun fire, and two PT boats closed into support. With 100 rounds from flak boats added to this fire, the machine guns were silenced. Two waves of landing craft followed the buffaloes to the shore in rapid succession, and the narrow beaches backed either by jungle or high bluff were soon congested with assault troops. On the eastern beach, Troop A began a vigorous drive towards the Lugo's Mission and the No. 3 road leading to the Laurengau Airdrome. Captain Raymond Jennings led the troop to storm the bluff where Lugo's Mission was located, and he overran the mission before a few Japanese who had survived the bombardment could put up any effective opposition. The men worked their way into the mission compound and cleared out the area with grenades. Troop A was soon on its way along the No. 3 road, leaving behind some 20 dead SNLF, without the loss of a single cavalryman. Meanwhile, Troop C advanced west 800 yards to a ridge where they stopped and dug in, having accomplished their mission of establishing a defensive perimeter to protect the landing of successive elements. Other waves of the 1st and 2nd Squadrons began landing ashore as the 7th Cavalry took up the beachhead. Other waves of the 1st and 2nd Squadrons began landing ashore as the 7th Cavalry took up the beachhead. The 2nd Squadron advanced over some ridges towards the No. 1 road, while Troop A reduced enemy bunkers, progressing roughly a mile from the beach. By 11:20 a.m., they came across three mutually supporting bunkers that halted their advance. It took Troop B's support alongside artillery and aerial bombardment to destroy the bunkers so that they could advance. Meanwhile, the 1st Squadron emerged out of the jungle into a clearing at 5 p.m., where they occupied a ridge overlooking the southern edge of the airdrome. There they would have to dig in. The 2nd Squadron reached No. 1 road, where they ran into three bunkers, and the following morning, with tank support, the squadron overran the bunkers and advanced northeast towards Laurengau. The cavalrymen would destroy seven bunkers during their trek before halting 100 yards before Laurengau. To the north, Troop A was clearing a coconut grove north of the airstrip, from which Japanese snipers were harassing them throughout the night. Troop C advanced along the southern edge near the airstrip, where they came across another pack of bunkers. Since the snipers north of the strip had been cleared out by noon, an attack could be made out in the open now. Troop B, supported by light tanks on their left, advanced down the strip, followed by Troop D and the Squadron HQ. Troop A advanced across the strip and then east along the northern edge. By 1 p.m., Troop C managed to destroy two bunkers using grenades, forcing the Japanese inhabitants to flee out into the open where they were cut down. Troop C then was about to dash across the airstrip when they suddenly became pinned down by friendly fire from Troop B, who were trying to disengage the enemy before them. The 1st Squadron suffered 9 deaths and 19 wounded during this action. Mudge then ordered them to relieve Troop C, who were holding some high ground south of the airstrip. On the morning of the 17th, after extensive naval and artillery bombardment, Mudge launched a coordinated attack with the 2nd Squadron, advancing south of the airstrip, and the 1st Squadron assaulting the bunkers that had held up the 8th Cavalry's advance. The bombardments had nearly annihilated the bunkers, allowing the 1st Squadron to face only slight resistance. They soon attacked a secondary Japanese position further east upon a ridge. This position was also met with artillery and mortar fire, and would fall by 11:30 a.m. After this, the cavalrymen were able to obliterate the remaining pillboxes and advance across the pulverized airstrip. Meanwhile, the 2nd Squadron of the 7th and 8th Cavalry Regiments linked up along the No. 1 road near Laurengau. The 8th Cavalry had encountered little resistance on the road, destroying whatever bunkers were encountered with the aid of fire from medium tanks. The light tank accompanying the squadron had a track blown off by the first Japanese anti-tank mine encountered in the operation. By 1 p.m., all of the frontline troops around the airstrip to No. 1 road linked up, forming a general advance. By this point, the backbone of the enemy's resistance had been broken, leaving little resistance to them. For the next 1,500 yards to the river, it took them 2 hours because the Japanese had hurriedly put in large quantities of anti-tank and anti-personnel mines. They had been emplaced, however, with no prepared plan, and many were poorly camouflaged or left lying completely on the surface. The Japanese had also dug holes and refilled them without emplacing any mines. As the cavalrymen slowly made their way to the river, they suffered a few casualties from the mines. The 7th Cavalry reached the Laurengau River by 3 p.m., and from there they dispatched a reconnaissance platoon, who quickly came under fire from bunkers atop some hills overlooking Laurengau. Laurengau was sheltered in a valley surrounded by jungle-covered hills rising 400 feet. The Japanese believed an attack would come from the sea, thus many of their defenses were sited to cover the shoreline. The offshore approaches and the three roads entering the settlement from the east, south, and north were also covered by defensive positions. From the position held by the 2nd Brigade, the only approach to the town was over a sandbar at the mouth of the Laurengau River, a slow-moving stream 20 yards wide and 10 to 20 feet deep, except at the sandbar. The beach area, which the troops would then have to cross, was heavily protected. Naval demolition mines containing 20 pounds of black powder that detonated by a master switch located in the control bunker up the hillside covered the beach. About 100 yards inland from the beach, a series of rifle pits and gun emplacements were constructed on the side of a dike, which paralleled the shore. On the hills surrounding the harbor, beach, and town, about a dozen heavy bunkers were used to reinforce the fires of the beach defenses and to add depth to the position. As usual, these bunkers were carefully camouflaged, although the concentration of naval and artillery fire, as well as repeated bombings, had disclosed the location of several. Mudge ordered the men to dig in for the night on the western bank of the river and establish a perimeter defense against some expected counterattacks that would not actually develop in the end. The next morning, after a mortar and artillery bombardment, the 2nd Squadron 8th Cavalry advanced down from its ridge positions to the mouth of the Broad River, with its reconnaissance platoon leading. Upon fording the river, the cavalrymen only faced a handful of machine guns, facing almost no opposition. The squadron was thus able to secure Laurengau, counting about 87 dead Japanese in the remains of the town. Colonel Izaki seemed to have disappeared during the battle over Papdalai, leaving his men leaderless. The Japanese naval troops, in desperation, began retreating towards Rosum, with the American patrols hot on their trail. There would be furious fights down the Rosum Road. 1st Lieutenant James Concannon captured an enemy map of the area during his patrol, to which he exclaimed, "Well, here goes Concannon to get himself a Purple Heart." Lieutenant Concannon's platoon had been ordered to go along No. 2 Road, which went to Rosum, and from there to Callao Harbor, through the heart of the Japanese defenses indicated on the captured map. Hardly had the platoon crossed the outpost line, still held by Troop E, along the No. 2 road when they came under heavy fire from a pair of bunkers sighted to cover the track. Lieutenant Concannon and one of his men were wounded immediately. The platoon sergeant assumed command and attempted to flank the position. When the attempt was not successful, the sergeant decided to withdraw and report what had happened, as his mission was one of reconnaissance. Upon receiving the information that the enemy was in a position not 200 yards from the outpost line, Colonel Bradley directed Major Shore to send Troop A back up the track to neutralize the enemy position. The troop was reinforced with machine guns and two 37mm anti-tank guns. Troop A of the 8th Cavalry were ordered to deal with the newly discovered enemy bunkers. Corporal Peter Armstrong and Armando Valencia set their heavy machine guns in position at a range of 30 yards from one of the bunkers. Having disclosed his position by laying a continuous burst of fire on the bunker, Corporal Armstrong was wounded by sniper fire. Armstrong continued firing until the grenade knocked him unconscious. Although the gun had been hit in several places and was leaking a steady stream from its water jacket, Corporal Valencia took over and continued firing at the bunker slits until the machine gun froze. Then he fired with his submachine gun until it was knocked out of his hands by an enemy bullet. In the meantime, Motus had obtained 4 direct hits on the bunkers, and the anti-tank guns had made 2. Corporals Armstrong and Valencia were awarded with the Distinguished Service Cross, and for the actions during the day, Troop A was given a unit citation. After taking out the stubborn position, Troop A advanced along the road under heavy sniper fire until they were relieved by Troop C. Troop C immediately was met with heavy Japanese counterattacks shortly after nightfall. The counterattack was launched by 8 Japanese using rifle grenades and small arms. Considering the size of the attacking force, the casualties of the troop were heavy, 2 killed and 10 wounded. All of the Japanese were killed, largely due to a quick adjustment by the forward observer of the 61st Field Artillery Battalion, followed by 4 volleys fired for effect. By this point, the Americans had achieved all of their objectives for the Admiralty Islands campaign. The only thing left to do was to mop up the islands. The remaining IGA troops were now withdrawing across the Launu Passage over to Manus. The 8th Cavalry would soon be given the task of clearing the eastern end of Manus, while the 7th Cavalry would clear out the Rossum Road. Yet that is all for today for this campaign, as we are now going to head over to New Guinea. General MacArthur was planning his new Western New Guinea offensive. After the directives given on March the 12th, Admiral Nimitz had been instructed to provide support for his Hollandia operation. The Japanese began their occupation of Hollandia early in April of 1942, but they paid little attention to the region for over a year. Then Allied air reconnaissance disclosed that the enemy was constructing airfields on the Lake Satani Plain. This development progressed slowly until late 1943, by which time successive reverses in the air and on the ground in eastern New Guinea and the Bismarck Archipelago, together with increasing shipping losses in the same region, began to demonstrate to the Japanese the vulnerability of their air and supply bases east of Hollandia. In late 1943 and early 1944, the Japanese built 3 airfields on Lake Santani Plain and started a 4th at Same, on the seacoast east of Homolt Bay. In addition, because of the shipping losses east of Hollandia, the Japanese began to develop Homolt Bay into a major supply base and a transshipment point. Large ships would unload at Hollandia, whence cargo would be carried by barge to points southeast along the coast of New Guinea, as far as Wewak, over 215 miles away. Much of the cargo in the large ships remained at Hollandia to build up its base there. Admiral Nimitz decided to dispatch 2 fast carrier groups of Admiral Mitscher's Task Force 58 to conduct fighter sweeps against Hollandia and the Wakde Sarmi area in order to keep their airfields neutralized. MacArthur sought for the carriers to support the troops for 8 days after the landings, but Nimitz believed this would put the carriers at risk, because the Japanese would be able to launch aircraft from all over the Dutch East Indies, or even from the Philippines. Thus it was decided Task Force 58 would remain in the Hollandia area for about 3 days after the landings were made. As a result of this, MacArthur opted to supplement using land-based aircraft against Hollandia. To obtain this, he would need to capture an airfield in northern New Guinea, just east of the main objective. MacArthur chose Aitipe. It was a lightly guarded area and already partially developed by the Japanese, such as its incomplete airfields around the Taji Plantation. Once the men landed ashore at Aitipe, Allied forces could provide flank protection for Hollandia against any westward actions by the Japanese 18th Army. For the assault against Aitipe, MacArthur planned to use the 8 escort carriers of Task Force 78 under the command of Rear Admiral Ralph Daviseau. Now for the amphibious assault, Admiral Kincaid gave the job to Admiral Barbie's Task Force 77, who were divided into 3 groups. They would bring over General Eichelberger's 1st Corps, who would perform the Hollandia operation, codenamed Operation Reckless. I'd say it's a pretty suitable name for a MacArthur operation. For the Hollandia part of the operation, the 19th and 21st Regiments of Major General Frederick Irving's 24th Division would land at Tanimura Bay. The 162nd and 186th Regiments of General Fuller's 41st Division would land at Homolt Bay. For the operation against Aitipe, codenamed Operation Persecution, the 163rd Regiment of the 41st Division, led by General Doe, would perform the initial landings. To soften up the enemy, General Kenny's air forces began bombing Wewak and Hansa in mid-March. Then in early April, they began neutralizing the airfields to try and deceive General Adachi into believing they were the next Allied target. Additionally, MacArthur asked Admiral Spruance to carry out a carrier raid against the Palau Islands, codenamed Operation Desecrate 1, followed by strikes at Yap and Wallai in the Eastern Carolines, in order to prevent the Japanese from reinforcing Western New Guinea. Admiral Mitscher's carriers departed Majuro on the 22nd of March, and they made their way around the Carolines, trying to sneak past Truk undetected. Despite their best efforts, Japanese search planes from Truk managed to spot them on the third day at sea. This prompted Admiral Spruance to advance the day of the raid from April the 1st to March the 30th. Meanwhile, after sighting the Allied naval forces, Admiral Koga ordered an evacuation of Palau, seeing a large number of warships and merchant shipping flee the area for Tawi Tawi. The U.S. submarines Gar, Blackfish, Tang, and Archerfish were stationed to operate against the withdrawing ships and as plane guards. On the 23rd, Tunney sank the Japanese submarine I-42 and damaged the 14,850-ton tanker Iro. To the north of Palau, during an attack on the 26th, Talabi was hit and sunk by our own circling torpedo. Basha torpedoed the 4,317-ton freighter escorted by the destroyers Minazuke and Yuzuki. On the 29th, the super battleship Musashi departed Palau under the cover of darkness to avoid an expected air raid and encountered Tunney, which fired six torpedoes at the battleship. Five of them missed, but the six blew a hole 5.8 meters in diameter near the bow, flooding her with 3,000 tons of water. The torpedo hit killed seven crewmen and wounded another 11. After temporary repairs, Musashi sailed for Japan later that night and arrived at Kure Naval Arsenal by April the 3rd. On the 30th, Task Force 58 reaches Assembly Point, 90 miles south of the Palau Islands. The task force was met with a Japanese airstrike consisting of mostly Bettys and Oscars, who were easily just swept aside. Then, fast carriers Enterprise, Bunker Hill, Hornet, Yorktown, and Lexington launched their first airstrikes against the Palau Islands. For the next day and a half, the Americans flew hundreds of sorties around the island, striking the airfields and shooting down all planes that they could find. The attack saw 40 Japanese ships at Palau and Anguar sunk, and another four were badly damaged. 93 aerial victories would be won over Palau, and the Avengers from Lexington, Bunker Hill, and Hornet laid extensive mines around the channels and approaches to the Palau Islands. This was the first tactical aerial mining of the Pacific War performed by carrier aircraft. In response, Admiral Koga asked for help from neighboring islands. He received 9 B-6N torpedo bombers from Yap, who attempted a night attack against the Task Force 58 on the 31st. Unfortunately for the Japanese, four Hellcats from Cabot managed to intercept them and successfully shot all of them down. Admiral Koga certainly had a lot on his plate. Due to the recent attacks against Truk and now the Palau Islands, he decided to transfer his HQ from Musashi to Davao on March the 31st. Most of his senior staff and cryptographers boarded three H-8K flying boats en route to Mindanao from Palau. All three of the flying boats ran straight into a typhoon just off Cebu, and two of them got lost. These flying boats were carrying Admiral Koga and Vice Admiral Fukudome Shigeru, his chief of staff. Koga's plane would end up crashing en route to Davao, killing all aboard. Thus, another commander-in-chief of the IGN forces had met his end to a plane crash. The other plane carrying Fukudome crashed off the coast of Cebu. Fukudome had a harrowing experience, but escaped the aircraft and began swimming to the island. To make matters even worse for the Japanese, while swimming, Fukudome was grabbed by Filipino guerrillas who brought him over to Lieutenant Colonel James Cushing. Cushing was a former engineer in the Philippines who was helping organize a resistance movement. Now, captured Fukudome was certainly a large prize, yet an even bigger one would come on April the 3rd. A Filipino shopkeeper named Pedro Gantangwoku spotted a box floating offshore on the 3rd. He picked it up in his fishing boat. The box contained a red leather briefcase carrying the Z-Plan. Fukudome had assumed the box had sunk with the aircraft, but in a twist of fate, it did not. Now, while all of this was going on, Lieutenant Colonel Saete Onishi had dispatched troops to search for the survivors of the aircrafts that had crashed and for the box containing the Z-Plan. Onishi had hundreds of Filipino villagers interrogated, tortured, and killed. Entire Filipino villages were burnt to the ground. Eventually, Onishi cornered Cushing, and they struck a deal. On April the 10th, with Japanese forces on Cebu hot on the heels of the guerrillas, Lieutenant Colonel Cushing arranged to return Fukudome and the other prisoners to the Japanese in return for a cessation of the massacre of Filipino civilians. 3 days later, the Filipinos who had found the box containing Plan Z in the codebook when it had washed ashore turned them over to Cushing. The codebook was recognized for what it was when the guerrillas discovered the Japanese were now offering 50,000 peso rewards for its return. On April the 27th, Cushing arranged for the items to be picked up by the submarine Crevel. Traveling mostly on the surface for speed and driving only when needed, the submarine survived depth charges twice, finally arriving at Darwin on May the 19th. From there, the documents were flown over to Brisbane later that day. Allied codebreakers looked forward with anticipation to the arrival of the codebook, since they had been stymied by changes to the IGN code since the summer of 1942, and had not really read the enemy's mail in much detail since the week before the Battle of Midway. The documents outlined the new strategy for the defense of the inner perimeter islands around Japan, with the intention of drawing the U.S. fleet in for a decisive showdown. The documents were sent over to Admiral Nimitz, and they would prove extremely valuable during the Battle of the Philippine Sea. The documents were so vital, the Americans performed a covert operation sending them back to the Philippines by submarine and placing them near the wreckage of the flying boat by American divers. It was one of the greatest intelligence coups of World War II. Thus, Admiral Koga was dead, the Z plan had fallen into Allied hands, and the IGN were now leaderless. Koga's death would not be announced until May. He was replaced by Admiral Toyoda Soemiya. Koga was promoted to Marshal Admiral posthumously and granted a state funeral. According to pilot Nagasaki Reiji, "The death of Admiral Koga, successor to Admiral Yamamoto, had been another shock for the Japanese nation. These distressing circumstances have forced the naval and military chiefs of staff to resign. They have been replaced by General Tojo and Admiral Shimada." Now back to the invasion. On April the 1st, Rear Admiral John Reeves' carriers launched airstrikes against Yap and Ulithi, with three task groups then attacking Walai. 25 American aircraft were lost, with 26 out of 44 aircrews rescued thanks to the submarine Harder. Meanwhile, the fleet's Hellcats won 111 aerial victories and destroyed 46 grounded aircraft on the three atolls. After this, Task Force 58 had successfully removed Palau as a threat to the Islandia Itapi operation. Alongside this, South and the Southwest Pacific land-based aircraft from bases in eastern New Guinea and the Admiralties bombed islands in the eastern Carolines and undertook many long-range reconnaissance missions. Meanwhile, Kenny's air forces were busy neutralizing enemy bases in western New Guinea and the eastern islands of the Dutch East Indies. Most of the strategic support missions flown to the western New Guinea areas were undertaken by the U.S. 5th Air Force, while the Royal Australian Air Forces took responsibility for the majority of strikes against the islands in the eastern Dutch East Indies. The operations were intensified roughly 6 weeks before the landings at Hollandia and Itape. On March the 30th, Kenny shifted the weight of his attacks from the Wewak area to Hollandia, where the Japanese 6th Air Division had recently retreated from Wewak and received strong reinforcements too. The Air Forces also performed a full aerial reconnaissance taking photos of Hollandia's three airdromes. Added to this were radio interceptions and intelligence reports, allowing the Allies to estimate the Japanese had roughly 351 aircraft there. With this information on hand, Kenny launched Liberators armed with small 20-pound fragmentation bombs to perform a concentrated bombing against the enemy airfield. Since the Allies hoped to rehabilitate Hollandia's airstrips as quickly as possible, hits on the runways with heavy ordnance were to be avoided. Fighter cover would be provided by long-range P-38s, which would escort the bombers over the target, and by shorter-range P-47s, which would meet the bombers near Itape, beat off pursuing fighters, and shepherd them home. Medium and light bombers would continue attacks against the airfields at Wewak to prevent their use by Japanese fighters. The Liberators with their P-38s and P-47 escorts would smash the anti-aircraft defenses, while the medium and light bombers would drench the area with bombs. On March the 30th, 7 B-24s hit Hollandia's dispersals as 75 Liberators of the 43rd Bombardment Group and 59 P-38s of the 80th, 431st, and 432nd Fighter Squadrons swept over Hollandia's airstrips and dropped nearly 6,000 bombs. To make matters even worse for the Japanese, they suffered from insufficient radar warning. Many of their aircraft would be on the ground refueling after some morning patrols when this occurred. The 5th Air Force found countless enemy aircraft parked wingtip to wingtip along the runways, a lethargic anti-aircraft reaction as well. 25 or more fighters made eager passes against the 65th Bombardment Squadron, whose gunners claimed two destroyed. The 80th Fighter Squadron engaged a reported 35 to 40 hostile fighters, destroying seven of them. The 431st Fighter Squadron claimed one Tony damaged, but the 432nd encountered no enemy fighters. Japanese interception seemed really badly disorganized. The planes milled about with little evident formation, and most of the pilots appeared to have little desire for a fight. Over 100 aircraft would be destroyed as the Japanese were caught completely unprepared. Japanese POWs and capture documents later revealed that the reason the bombing operation was so successful was because the Japanese high command erroneously transported too many airplanes to Hollandia from the Philippines and the Dutch East Indies, but did not transport more pilots and maintenance crews with said planes. There was no way for them to build appropriate defensive shelters to protect all 400 aircraft, and there was also not enough trained pilots who could fly all these airplanes at the same time. So, many perfectly operational aircraft were left sitting there with no aircrew to maintain them. There was also the issue of morale at Hollandia's airbase being very low during the bombing operation, with many Japanese soldiers and airmen hiding in bunkers instead of manning anti-aircraft artillery and getting airplanes into the air. Most of these Hollandia soldiers and airmen were rear echelon and not combat-oriented at all because most of the combat-trained divisions from the 18th Army were recently sent further east towards WIWAC in anticipation for amphibious landings that would never come thanks to deception and feints carried out by General Kenny. The P-38s then withdrew to Nadsab, and as soon as the bombers cleared their targets, the P-47s, meeting the liberators near Aitape, convoyed them home without any incident. So successful was this raid that one squadron reported, "Hollandia has really been wee-whacked." The next day, Kenny launched a nearly identical mission with 70 Liberators and 52 P-38s bombing the dispersals at Hollandia, Cyclops and Santani's aerodromes. 153 tons of 100-pound demos, frags, and incendiary bombs were dropped. The Japanese anti-aircraft fire was more accurate this time, and around 56 Japanese fighters did give the Allies a fight. However, the pilots were inexperienced and unaggressive. The Americans estimated 14 aircraft were shot down, while they suffered the loss of one P-38. After the airstrike, the total number of destroyed aircraft on the ground reached 199. At this point, the Japanese scrambled to withdraw the remaining serviceable aircraft out of Hollandia. On April the 3rd, Kenny sent his heaviest air attack to date. 66 B-24s escorted by 21 P-38s that dropped 492 1,000-pound bombs on anti-aircraft defenses. An estimated 30 Japanese Tonys and Oscars attempted without any success to break up the bomb runs, and B-24 gunners claimed two fighters destroyed, while the 21 escorting P-38s of the 80th Squadron claimed downing 10. Then 96 A-20s escorted by 17 P-38s strafed and dropped 100-pound para-demolition bombs over the grounded aircraft, stores, and other targets of opportunity. The 432nd Squadron covering the A-20s with 17 P-38s encountered about 20 Japanese fighters and claimed 12 definitively destroyed, against the loss of just one P-38. Finally, 76 B-25s escorted by 36 P-38s swept the strips at noon, scattering parafrags and parademos and strafing everything in sight. Only three Japanese fighters were encountered in the last attack, and all of them were shot down. After the end of the raid, Hollandia was so badly mauled, it could no longer be considered a major air installation. A Japanese seaman, after hearing of the Allied mission of April the 3rd against Hollandia, although seemingly confused as to the Imperial folklore, correctly assessed the Allied victory. "Yesterday, the anniversary of the birthday of Emperor Meiji, we received from the enemy greetings, which amount to the annihilation of our Army Air Force in New Guinea." After April the 3rd, the 5th Air Force virtually owned the air over Hollandia. I would like to take this time to remind all of you that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Please go subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that you are still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, The Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I just released a full documentary on the Battle of Attu, and it's a bloody one. Also, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where you can find exclusive Patreon podcasts. Over there, I just released a two-part series on the entire history of the USS Enterprise, the Big E. She had an extensive service career and a lot of incredible stories, so please go check it out. The Admiralty Islands campaign was coming to a swift end, seeing MacArthur secure the valuable islands of Los Negros and Manus. MacArthur's new campaign to hit Western New Guinea and the Dutch East Indies certainly began with a bang, as General Kenny's air forces had basically claimed air supremacy. The Japanese were in full panic mode.